Okay, so we are holding on Chof Omer Aleph, about the middle of the wide line, the line against Yeshia. Today should really be Chof Aleph, all right, whatever. Okay, the Mishnah said of Chumavir Noy, so follow the Mishnah had said that when a king is served a Sudas Avra after a relative of his dies, then everybody else sits on the floor and he sits on a Dagish. What is a Dagish? My Dagish? Omer Ula Arsa Begada. So Ula says it is the bed of Malo. What is that? Rashi says that they used to set up a bed and a table in the house that were left unused. They were set as for the mazel of the house. Mishum nichush is the expression that Rashi uses. And Rashi explains the word God means mazel. The question, of course, is all the Rishonim asking, not allowed to do nichush. What are you talking about? You have a bed and a table for that person.
Magic.
So that would be awful. We're going to learn later on in the Sefta about the dinim of nichush. So you have a few different approaches among the Rishonim. You have the Rosh talks about an idea based on a Gemara in Pesachim that says that the Tsar, the Malach in charge of riches, is named Nakid or Nakid or Nakid or something, which is Malach and Nakid, cleanliness. So in other words, he's attracted to places that are clean, and therefore he brings along with him. He's the Eidrish Shliach to bring riches, to bring wealth to a place. Therefore, you want to clean when it's clean. Yes. So you want to have something clean. You want to have an unused bed or table in your house that's clean and nicely made and unused, so that it will attract this malach of riches to your house. So it's not nichush in the sense of like superstition. It's to attract that malach. And the Shittim Ukubethus, in fact, says on it, it's somewhat in that sense, it's somewhat similar to like putting out the case of Shalal Yoh, I agree.
Wow. Why should he be attracted to...
Because he's attracted to cleanliness, to neatness, like this. When you have a neatly made bed, why is he attracted?
Well,
I don't know.
That no one sleeps in.
So like this, a bed that nobody sleeps in is a neat bed.
Oh, that's great.
The Ran gives a different approach on it. He says the vorta is that people would have this extra bed or table in their house, which they didn't use, they meant it to evoke the idea that, look, the Eibishter has given me so much. I'm so sameach b'chelka, I'm so satisfied with what the Eibishter gave me, that I have even more than I need. I have even a bed that I don't even need to use.
Wow.
And therefore, it was used as a means of praising Hashem for his largesse. Yeah.
Do you have this in your house?
Well, we have a day bed, but sometimes people do sleep on it. So the Rabbanim asked Ula, if that's the case, if you're telling me that the king sits on this arsa de gada, mi ikamidi dada, I thought it wasn't working. Mi ikamidi dada idna loya svine vahashta musvinin lay. What's going on? You have this bed that up until now nobody has ever sat on it because it's only meant as part of the decoration of the house, and now all of a sudden that the king is an oval, you should sit him on it? What's the logic? So Rava asks right back, fires right back at the question, my kosha, why do you find that so difficult to understand? You could compare it to the situation with food and drink. Up until now, nobody ever gave the king food and drink, because it would be like sort of beneath his dignity, like he has to be fed, like he doesn't have resources of his own, and other people have to bring him. And now we're giving him food and drink. So why not? By the same logic, sure, until now he didn't sit on the arse of the gada, and now, under the circumstances, he does. Ela ikasha hokasha. No, rather the question you can ask is as follows. So that's not a good question in the first place. Not a good question, and therefore, yeah. So rather, the question can be as follows. A Braita says, now, there's a concept which we've learned before, we've learned it a few times, that part of the dinim of Avelos is that you're supposed to turn over all the beds in your house, and then you sleep on the overturned bed. We've talked before why we don't do it. We don't specifically cover the bed. We cover the mirror. Okay. Why we don't do this nowadays, why we don't overturn the beds, there's a few different approaches among the Rishonim. One is because our beds are anyway made differently than the ones in the time of the Gemara. If they're overturned, it's not as noticeable. There's also the idea that we live much more among the Goyim than they did in those days, and therefore they're going to see it as some type of kishuf. They're going to think we're practicing witchcraft against them, and it'll put us in danger. Whatever the case, them's the fact. We don't do it nowadays. But in those times they did it. And a Bryce says, Dargish ain't a tzarech l'chpoy. Say a Dargish does not have to be overturned. El is l'chpoy. All you do is you turn it on, you would make it stand up on its long side. If this is the Dargish, instead of having it normally, it's sitting like this. And with you put it like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So what's the purpose of doing this?
The purpose of turning over the bed, the Gemara mentions, I think, in Moed Katan, is that what does it represent? The idea that I think the idea is something along the lines of that other magician overturned things in the world by eating from Eitz Hadas. I don't remember exactly. No, not that. No, it's something along the lines of that the Eibishter gave you a neshama. And now, because of our Veda, overturned. Like now things are overturned in our lives.
So
therefore, you overturn the bed, and you sleep, and you sleep on the other side of the bed. But that's one of the things to demonstrate our Veda. But again, we don't do it nowadays. That's why you're not familiar.
Like tearing Kriya.
Anyway.
Covering your mirror.
Yeah, whatever. Anyway, the bottom line is. The bottom line is that you do have that concept, but we're saying that a daugish does not have to be overturned. It just has to be stood on its side. Now, if you're going to tell me that the daugish is an arsad gader, this bed that's in the house for mazel, am I in a sort of place? Why shouldn't you need to overturn it, Taka? When somebody overturns his bed, loy mitosibo vadu koifa, you don't only turn over your bed, the bed you actually sleep on, you have to overturn all the other beds that are in your house as a simon of mourning. So therefore, why shouldn't you have to overturn the arsa degada? Oh, the Gemara answers back still. My kusha, why do you think that that's such a hard thing to understand? Duma midi dehavam micham yuchedes lekelim. You could compare it, after all, to you might compare it to it's a bed that's used specifically for putting kelim on. The just like we did in the Mishnayot for an oval shlosh trisin hen, a pair of chabdal of kelim. We mentioned over there shlosh mitis hen. One of them is the point is that there you have a mitzvah which is not meant to sit or to lay on at all. It's used only for putting kelim on it. And the din is you taka don't have to overturn it. Because the din is you only have to overturn beds that are meant for sitting or lying on. So fine, by that logic, maybe taka you don't have to overturn a darvish because it's not yet. That's the point. Most beds in a house are meant to be eaten on or recline on while you're eating or sit on or whatever. A mitam yuchedis lekelim is not. And you could argue by the same logic. And arsa degada is not either.
The word bed is a little bit different.
The word bed, yes. It has a bit more of a broader meaning. It has something more between a bed and a couch nowadays, let's say. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe also the other. Yeah. Anyway. So that's not so difficult to understand then why indeed the daugish you should not have to overturn because you kind of don't sit on it. Okay. Dikatoni, and in fact the Braita continues. If you have a bed that's set aside specifically for putting kelim on, ain't it sort of with poison? You kind of don't have to overturn it. So fine, you don't have no reason. You should have to overturn a daugish. Eli kasha hokasha. No, but rather the question you can ask, again, on Ula's definition, that a daugish is an arsa degada, you can ask a different question. Namely, that the Braita continues, Rav Shimon Gamliel, Dargish, with a Dargish, he disagrees with the Tanakhama that you turn it on its side. He says that what you have to do is Matir Kavitin, you undo the loops of it, and it falls down on the floor of its own. In other words, as we're going to see soon, a Dargish is made, the mattress, so the mattress is attached to the frame using loops. So in that case, then, instead of, you don't overturn it like a regular bed, your Shimon Gamliel bed, you don't stand it on its side either. What you do is you undo the loops, and the piece, as we're going to see in a second, it's actually a piece of leather, falls onto the floor. With the idea being that way, you don't want to overturn it, because then the leather is going to be on the wet floor, the floor is in those times often the damp floor, and then it's going to be uncomfortable, and it can rot and whatever. So like this, you undo it, it falls down onto the floor, fine. The wrong side of it is on the floor, that's no problem. If that side gets wet, big deal, you're not sleeping on it anyway. The question then is, the Socratic arsa degada, if you're going to tell me that the daugish is an arsa degada, the problem is kabitin miyisla, it doesn't have roofs. It's made exactly like a regular bed. Regular beds in those days, as we're going to see on other days, were usually made by, they had ropes that were wound around a spring and tied together. They were made in a cross hatch pattern, in a shesi ve'erev, and tied around the wooden pieces of the bed and tied, and then they put, and then So, and then on top of that, they put a swirl mattress, a swirl-filled mattress or whatever. Yeah. There's no loops involved. Now, an Aris Betagada, being that it's made for the mazel of the house, it was made exactly like a regular bed, except that you didn't sleep on it. So that being the case, then, what loops? So it was the same kind of thing. It was a swirl mattress on top of a network of ropes. Yeah. So what loops? Eloh, he also Robin. So no, when Robin came from Eretz Yisrael to Babel, Omar, he said that Omar Yahu Mirabonon, Rav Tachlifa Shnei, one of the Rabbanon named Rav Tachlifa told me, and this Rav Tachlifa to have a Shiach B'Shufa de Gildai, he was often found in the marketplace where the leather workers or the leather sellers did their work or did their sales. He said, Va'amalei, and he said to him, or he said to me rather, my darvish arsit salah, what are the darvish of our Mishnah that the king sits on when he's in Oval, is not, like we were saying, the arsit agada all the time. Rather, it is a bed made with leather. So again, unlike a regular bed where you have a network of ropes and then on top of it you have a straw mattress, an arsit salah, a leather bed, so Rashi describes it, what it is you have straps on the end, along the ends of the leather. Leather straps that are attached to it. When you want to set it out, what you do is you take the straps and wind them around the sides of the bed, the poles of the bed, and you tie them. So now, if you undo those, then it folds. That's the kibitin, the loops that we're talking about are those things. Now again, the point is Rashi says that you don't want to turn over such a bed because then the top side of the leather, unlike in such a bed, you sleep directly on the leather. Unlike with a regular bed, you sleep on a straw mattress which is on top of the ropes. So a regular bed, you turn it over, the ropes are on the ground, big deal. You're going to put a mattress on top of them anyway. A leather bed, an Aris of the Sally, you're going to be sleeping directly on the leather. Therefore, you don't want it to get wet or whatever from the damp floor. Therefore, what you do is, so the Tanakhama says, you turn it sideways. You take the bed, which normally is lying like this, and turn it on its side like this. And Rav Shimon Gamliel says, rather, what you do is undo the straps, undo the loops, let the piece of leather fall down on the ground, and fine, the wrong side of the leather will be on the ground. Big deal. That's not the side you sleep on
anymore. Well, I understand. It's not going to be standing and sleeping on it.
What do you mean? How do you? You don't sleep on a darvish normally. A darvish is a leather bed. You only use it, I guess, like a cot. Rather than as a regular bed. A regular bed would be made with straw and with ropes. So you turn that over and you sleep on the other side.
Boy, am I glad the
modern still sleeping on it.
Okay, but you're sleeping on it. That's fine. Okay. Omer Rav Yirmiya, Omer Rav Yechanan. And so Rav Yirmiya says in the name of Rav Yechanan, and here's another difference between a dargish and a regular bed. Dargish siruga mitoichai, a dargish, the tying of it is done from inside of it, which means, in other words, so in the poles, in the wooden framework of the bed, when it comes to a dargish, what you have is there are holes, there are slots along the length, that cut in various places along the length of it. What you do in the beams of the bed, the long beams of the bed that run along the sides of the bed, yeah, you have slots cut in them in various places. What you do is, how do you attach the leather piece, the leather mattress of the dargish there? You put these straps of it, that are the straps which are part of the leather, you put them through those slots and tie them in place. So they're not tied over the top of the bed, they're tied through it. As opposed to mita siruga malgaba, as opposed to with a regular bed, the ropes are woven back and forth. They're woven or tied over the poles of the bed. So you take the rope, you do like this, and then you go back and forth. Or you do it once or twice or whatever over the sides and then pull it across.
Over the frame,
yeah. Because it makes you have a contradiction. A Mishnah says in Kalim, Clay eighth name is Makabal Tumah. The general rule with Kalim is they're not Makabal Tumah until the work of making them is finished. So when it comes to wooden Kalim, at what point are they Makabal Tumah? Here's some examples. Hamita Vaharisa, a bed or a crib. Mishi Shufin Ba'or Adog, they're only Makabal Tumah. When are they considered finished? When you rub them with fish skin. Fish skin was their equivalent in those days of sandpaper. So you'd sand them in order to smooth them out to make them look nice. Or the bar
fish skin
was
you,
they sanded.
Oh, I thought it was the oil and the fish skin was making it.
It may be. I mean, Rashi says over here it's in order to make them smooth and beautiful. The Bartanura on the Mishnah over there says to take out the splinters. So that might be a difference. Yeah, it might be that both. The oil of the fish skin helps make it glossy and whatever. And so it would stink. Fine.
People
were used to smells in those days.
There was an animal living 5 feet away from you anyway.
This is true. Okay.
It probably made it smell good.
Like so the question is, the imita misdiregasi malgaba. Now, if you're going to tell me that you make a bed, that you make a bed, that you put you wind the ropes over the framework of the bed, then the whole thing is covered up with the ropes. Lomali shifa seradav. Why would you bother rubbing it with fish skin? They're all going to be covered anyway with the ropes. They're going to be wound around and around the framework.
Use the fish skin.
No, not that you use the fish skin not killer, but why would you bother if the whole thing is going to be covered with ropes all the time anyway? Yeah. Ella, no. No, rather you have to say both a dagish and a regular bed, the connection of the ropes to the straps to the framework of the bed is through the frame. The difference is mita The difference is that with a bed, they go in and out of slots that are cut in the wood. Again, just like what we thought before is true with a dagish. No, it's true of a regular bed. You have slots cut in the side where you put in the rope through the slots at one end, and then you put it back in through the other end. Not really slots and holes, but like you have pairs of holes, let's say. So you have a hole here and a hole here, and another one here and another one here. So you put the rope through one hole and then out through one hole and then in through the next one and go back and forth like that. As opposed to with a dargish, what you do is, because it's not ropes, because it's straps made out of leather, what you have is there are loops attached to those slots or those holes on the side of the bed, and those loops are what you tie the straps of the leather to. So those are the loops we were talking about. When Shimon Gamliel said before, you undo the loops and the leather of the dargish falls onto the floor, that's what he meant.
They replace the holes.
So that they replace the holes, right. Amar Rabbi Yaakov, Amar Rabbi Shimon. Maybe halacha could have Shimon Gamliel. The halacha is taka like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, that when it comes to a dagish, a leather bed, a leather top, like we just described, you don't turn it on its side for avelos. You undo the loops and let the leather fall down onto the ground.
Today,
our beds we don't do at all. We don't do anything with our beds nowadays for the reasons that we said before. Either because our beds are constructed differently and therefore turning them over wouldn't be as noticeable as it was in those days, or because the goyim are going to suspect us of kishur for other such things. And here's another din. If you have a bed.
In Israel, they should do it.
No, because even in Eretz Yisrael, up until recent times, they were living mostly among the goyim. And run one now. Okay, but once the thing went out of use, once the thing went out of use, we're not going and reviving ancient minhagim. Okay. Amar Rabbi Yaakov Ami, mita shenakli teir yotzin. What if you have a bed where the poles for the canopy stick out? So you have naklitim, or you have a bed and you have a pole at each end where you hang a sheet or something over it to make a canopy. So now you have those two sticking up. You can't overturn the bed, so you can't stand on two things like that. So the dayo is the same kind of thing. All you do is you turn it on its side, you turn your bed on its side, so it stays like this for the week of Shiva, and that's enough.
Why wouldn't it stay like this? Better?
Same thing, whatever. The point is that you put it on one side or another. You're not upside down as opposed to a regular bed. Yeah. All right, the Mishnah continues now with dinim that apply to a king, to a Jewish king. But a king is allowed to bring out the soldiers to fight a mochemes ha-rashos, which we learned in the previous perek, basically means any war that's not to defend the Jewish people against their enemies or who are already attacking, or to conquer Eretz Yisrael. They're more like the wars of David HaMelech, to enlarge Eretz Yisrael, to make the surrounding nations fear the Jewish people so they won't attack in the future, those sorts of things. Those are most famous.
Is only a melech capable of doing that?
Yes. I'll be based in Shoshivim Ve'achad, and he needs the consent of the based in of 71, as we learned in the first parak. He also needs the Urim B'Tumim. Yeah, it's a whole procedure.
But if there's no melech.
If there's no melech, then technically you can't do a mochemes ha-rashos. Technically, all you can do is a mochemes ha-tzoiva, which is to defend the Jewish people from enemies. Yeah.
There's nothing. It would have been that.
The king is allowed to break through to make himself a path, for example, to break through people's fences or properties or whatever to make a road. And nobody is allowed to protest. Rashi understands that what it means is we're talking about the king himself has a property. He himself has a field, let's say, and he needs a path to get in and out of that field. He's allowed to just expropriate a path to that field. Basically. The Rambam understands it differently, which is, this is a part of Masas Laderach, is specifically talking about, for example, when he needs a road for his army to travel through. We're not talking about for his, we're not talking about for his own estates or whatever. We'll get to what about his own estate? He would not be allowed to. He'd have to pay for it. We're going to see soon. We're going to talk. Tosfos talks soon in connection with the Gemara. We'll see. Tosfos discusses about the whole story of Achav and Navos. We all know the famous story that Achav goes to Navos, and Navos has a vineyard right next to Achav's palace in Israel. The capital was in Shomron, but Achav also had a palace in Israel. But Navos owned a vineyard right next door, which is he'd inherited the land from his ancestors. Achav comes in one day and offers and says, "I'd like to buy it from you. I'd like to turn it into a vegetable garden." And Navos refuses. And the upshot is that Achav is very Achav is a king, but Navos. Oh, that's what Tosfos is going to discuss. Wait. Tosfos is going to discuss exactly that. I'm telling you the basic what it says in the Pesukim. We'll see in Tosfos. We'll analyze it on PLO. Anyway, Achav goes home. He's very upset. Izebel tells him, "Some king you are. Let me show you how a king acts." Remember, she came from a Goyish country. She came from Sur. Her name was Izebel. Izebel, the wife of Achav. Yeah, Jezebel. Yeah. So she says, I'll show you how a king acts. To make a long story short, she has trumped up charges brought against Navos. She has him executed, and fine, then you take it over, eminent domain. Not eminent domain, but then you take over. When a criminal is executed for rebellion against the king, then his property gets taken over by the king. And Eliyahu comes and then gives Achav Musa for it. And, okay, anyway, onward. So we'll see in Tosfos what were the details of halacha involved in this. Okay. Whether she was actually still a goita, I don't know. I mean, not necessarily. She might have converted, but it wasn't might be that it was only pro forma. She's doing it in order to marry a king. Whatever. Okay. And Lechora, I mean, you know, his children after him were considered kings of Yisrael, and they were considered Jewish kings. They wouldn't have if she had been a goita, right? So she must have. Okay. Fine. She's not enough money. Fine. What? Okay. Onward. Okay. Derech HaMelech Ein L'Shir continues the Mishnah, a road for a king, there's no fixed amount, however much he needs.
When the king goes across the field without asking for a sheep, does he have to indemnify the field owner?
So he does have to indemnify the guy, but he's still allowed to do it without first asking for permission.
No. But there has to be an indemnification.
Derech HaMelech Ein L'Shir, now, when it comes to war, everybody goes, when everybody captures spoils, they have to first put it in front of him, and he gets a portion first, and then everybody else divides what he left over. We'll see in the Gemara. Boizdin means they take spoils. Okay, so the Gemara starts off. What does the Mishnah have to tell us that the king is, that the king has to have the consent of the Sanhedrin in order to bring out the people for Mohammed's Rishus? We learned it already in the first parak. Ein mitzi in the Mohammed's Rishus, el api based in Shoshim Ve'echad. So why are we repeating it over here? The answer is, I did itonu kol mida demelach, fine. But since our Mishnayas are listing the various dinim that apply to a king, tonanami mitzi in the Mohammed's Rishus. So the Mishnah also mentions, by the way, what his role is as far as war. But it's true, the actual din we learned in the previous parak. Okay, so now we need a bit of background for this next piece of Gemara. In Sefer Shmuel, in Perek Ches of Shmuel Aleph, the Jewish people come to Shmuel and they say, "We want a king." Shmuel is very upset. He goes to the Eivishter. The Eivishter tells him, "Don't be so upset. It's nothing against you personally. It's they're not just rejecting you; they're rejecting me as king."
What's the time period for that?
Time period is at the end of the time of the Shoftim. We're talking the Jewish people are being threatened by the Plishtim and the Ammonim and various other peoples and whatever. So they're saying, "Give us a king." They tell him, "Give us a king." L'shoftenu k'chol ha'goyim. No, the Shoftim were ruling it. The Shmuel was leading the Jewish people all the time. There's no king. There's Shoftim. The Shmuel was the last of them. Anyway, so the Eivishter tells Shmuel, they're rejecting me as well. By rights, they should realize the Eivishter is their king. But fine, if they want a king, tell them what's going to be involved. And the next day, Shmuel calls them all together and reads them off a whole passage describing what the king is going to do. I'll read off a few psukim over here from I'll read off a few psukim of what he says over there to give you a feel for it. And then we're going to discuss in the Gemara what is he telling them? Is he telling them that this is what a king is allowed to do al pi halacha? but eventually you're going to find that you regret it. Or is he telling them, a king is not allowed to do these things off the halacha. But practically speaking, kingship always ends up as, it always ends up as a tyranny, and the guy does whatever he wants, and therefore he's going to start doing these things, and you're going to regret it. So he tells them, for example, he says, this is going to be the kind of thing that the king who rules over you do, he says. He starts off saying, he'll take your sons and appoint them to be in it, to drive his chariot, and to be his horseman, and to run in front of his chariot, and to make captains of thousands and fifties in his army, and to plow his fields, to harvest his grain, to make the equipment he needs for warfare. He's going to take your daughters and use them in the palace for cooks and bakers and perfumers. He's going to take your best fields and your best vineyards and your best olive groves and give them to his servants, and he continues several more psukim in that vein. So the question is, is he telling them things that a king is allowed to do up the halacha, or is he telling them things that, practically speaking, kings end up doing these kinds of things? But that's the question. So, one second. Amr Rav Yehuda Amr Shmuel, kala Amr Parshas Melech, Melech Mutabai. Rav Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, everything that Shmuel is describing over there, the king has every right to do it. Yeah. On the other hand, Rav Amar Leinera Parsha Zerulah Ayim Aleim. On the other hand, Rav is saying that no, this Parsha that Shmuel is telling them is just to scare them. Now, what does it mean to scare them? Rashi says it means that they should respect the king. They should fear the king, realizing that he would be able to do these. Not that he's allowed to do them, but that he would be able, according to Rav, he's not allowed to. Wait. According to Rav, we're saying he's not allowed to. Now, there are, Rashi brings a girsa over here, well, actually, in the next piece, Rashi brings a girsa, but rejects it, that l'yarom l'balam, that Shmuel is trying to scare them out of having a king in the first place. Rashi says that no, because the fact is, there is a mitzvah to appoint a king, as we're going to say in a minute, and therefore, how can he be trying to talk them out of it? But wait, we'll get to that.
Also, Hashem told them that
it's... Yeah, the Avisha tells them in Parashat Shoftim, that if you say, so wait, we'll get to that soon. Okay. This parasha is only told them in order to make them fear the king. As the Pasuk says, you shall certainly place a king over yourself, implying you have to have respect, you have to have fear for the king. So therefore he's telling them what you may end up having to do for the king, even though maybe la'alacha he doesn't have the ability to do that. Now, here's where Tosfos discusses, according to Shmuel, the Amora Shmuel, that is, says that a king has all the rights to do these things that the Navi Shmuel is listing, then why is Achaz punished for the story with Navi? If Navi refuses to sell him his vineyard, on the face of it, we're saying the king has the ability to take things has the right to do eminent domain. Well, that's true, but the point is, in other words, so fine, the fact that it went that far is not wrong, but according to that, why was Achav so upset? Before we got there, why is Achav so upset? Why is Achav figuring so upset and then sitting over there and saying, I can't do anything. He said, I don't want to sell you my vineyard, and therefore there's nothing I can do about it. Why not? Why was he not allowed to do it? So, Tosfos gives a few answers. Number one, Shmuel, the Navi, says over there, he uses the expression that he can take your vineyards and your olive groves and whatnot and give them to his servants. Doesn't mean he can take them for himself. He can use them, for example, to pay off when he has his servants to pay off or whatever. That's one. A second answer of Tosfos is that it's true. If he wanted to take it for free, he would have had the ability to, even for himself. However, here he Davka wanted, he asked to sell it to him. So Novice figured in that case, well, if you're asking me to sell, I have the ability to say no. If Achav, if Achav Lachapilla had gone to Novice and said, give me your vineyard, then Novice would have had no choice.
What did he ask him exactly?
He said, please, he said, sell me your vineyard. I want to turn it into a vegetable garden. The third answer that Tosfos gives is that Achav didn't just want it for a vegetable garden. Tosfos brings, based on other psukim, that a vegetable garden was a common place to worship of a Dezara. So therefore, in Hamiskatchim, Bamitanim, Alaganos, and after of Shabbos or Shoydish. So
cucumber, which is close.
That's later. About Malacha Kishurin, that's a different thing. But yeah. So therefore, that's another answer. He was punished for that he wants to take it, not to use it for a legitimate government use, but to use it for Avodah Zarah. Then there's another answer Tosfos brings from the Nakhda, and I don't know who that is, that it's only allowed, you're allowed to expropriate fields, but only the ones that are far away from the city, which aren't of such good quality. This one is right there in the city, right next to the palace. Location, location, location. You're not just allowed to take that.
They have to pay for it.
Yeah. And the guy has the right to refuse, as Novi did. And a fifth answer to
you refuse the sale, but refuse the amount.
No, he could whatever he wants. He has full right. And the fifth answer that Tosfos gives is that when are you allowed to expropriate a field as a field that one person bought from another one, where anyway it's going to return in yovel. Here was a field that Novi inherited from his ancestors. You have no right. A king has no right to take that. And in fact, Novi says exactly that. Chalila, that I should sell my father's nachla to you. And then Tosfos gives the sixth answer that maybe Parshas HaMelech only applies to a king who rules over all the 12 shvatim. Achav ruled only over the 10 shvatim. I mean, some other Rishonim argue with that one, because they say, of course, the kings of Yisrael were legitimate kings. Rule over 10 shvatim, but more to the point, it started with the Navi Achi Ashiloni, came to Yerovam and told them the kingdom is going to be split and you're going to have 10 shvatim. And said, yeah, so therefore, so there is a certain legitimacy. Okay, anyway, so those are the various answers. All right, let's get back to the Gemara. Ketanoi, this machlokas, Rav and Shmuel, about whether a king is taka allowed to do these things that Shmuel warned him about, is the same as a machlokas tanoim. Rav Yosi and the Kolam and Parshas Melech, Melech Motavoy. Rav Yosi says that everything that it says in this Parshas Melech, a king is taka allowed to do al pi alocha. Rav Yehuda and the name of Parshas Melech, Kedei la'ayim alayim. And Rav Yehuda says that this parasha was only told to them in order to make them fear the king. Or again, Rashi brings the Girsa, but rejects it, that he's trying to scare them out of having a king in the first place. Shenema son tos malacha melech, as the Pasuk says, you should certainly place a king over yourself. Shetei mafti alacha, meaning that his fear should be on you. V'chein hoye Rabbi Yehuda, the halacha, by the way, is like Shmuel and like Rabbi Yosi, that in fact, kol ha'amar parshas melech, melech mutar. But if you look in Rambam, Malachim, he lists each one of these things, that each one of these psukim that Shmuel says over there, and he describes what it means, what a king is allowed to do. He's taka allowed to, for example, let's say with the first ones, that he said that he's going to take his sons and make them captains in his army and make them drive his chariots and whatever. Yeah, he has the right to draft people for his army.
Right.
He has the right to draft girls to work in the royal kitchen, etc. Yeah, you have to pay them, but he has the right to, Okay. And so, in fact, Rabbi Yehuda also said, "Gimel mitzvah yistavu Yisrael b'shnisas ma'aretz." The Jewish people were commanded three mitzvahs when they came into Israel: lahamid lahamelach, number one, to set up a king; or lahachos darit, not in this order. Actually, we're saying them a bit out of order, but yeah. Or lahachos, no, they actually are in order. Sorry. Or lahachos darit shal amolik, and to wipe out amolik, the libnas lahen beis abchira, and to build a beis mikdash.
We conquered their Israel first.
Yeah, but, no. This is lahachos darit shal amolik. There's a different thing. Rav Nehoroy, says a different explanation. Loy Nemra Parsha Zu Ela Keneged Taru Moisa. This parsha. Now we're not necessarily talking about the same parsha as Rashi says. We're not talking about the parsha of Shmuel anymore. Now we're talking about the parsha in the Torah, in Parsha Shoftim, when it says, "When you come to Yisrael, Yerushal Yashavtava, and you say of Simo Alai Melech Tzolag Goyim Asher Tzu Moisa." Now, the question really is, the Torah itself says that you're going to say, "I want a king like the nations around me," and then we find, when a few hundred years later, when they come to Shmuel and say, "We want a king to judge us like all the goyim," then Shmuel is upset. Now, why is he upset? The Torah says that the Torah gives that as a valid reason. Sort of Nehoroi says, "Well, never." The Torah says, on the face of it, it is. So that's what Rav Nehoroi is saying, it's taken out of mitzvah. Rav Nehoroi, I'm a lenemer parasha zuela keneged taru moisa. This parasha of Soim Tosim Alach HaMelech is not a mitzvah. The Eivishter realize that eventually they're going to complain like this, that we want a king, and therefore the Eivishter is not saying it's a mitzvah to make a king. Unlike Rav Yehuda, who said they have a mitzvah to appoint a king. Rav Nehoroi is saying it's not a mitzvah to appoint a king. When there comes a situation when the Jewish people start complaining like that, we want a king, then Eidishah says, fine, you can have a king, but here are the rules. If you're going to do it, then this is how it should be done. As the Pasuk says, if you shall say, I want to appoint myself a king like all the nations, then here are the rules. You have to be Me'achicha, he can't have too many wives, he can't have too many horses, as we're going to learn in the following Mishnah.
Horses be dying.
Yeah, we should have a certain amount, but there's a limit. Okay, Tanya.
Horses be dying?
Wait.
Are we supposed to have
horses? No, we'll learn tomorrow. You'll see the details. Okay, Tanya, Rabbi Yezaim. Kenim Shabadur Kahogan Shabu. Now, again, we have to ask, again, According to Rav Nahor Roy, the answer is very simple. Everybody acts improperly, and the Torah itself is telling you that's going to happen, that the Jewish people are going to act improperly for a king, and therefore the Eved is saying, when they do that, then here are the, and you should know here are the rules to keep in mind. But according to Rav Yehuda, that there's a mitzvah to appoint a king, and Rav Eliezer is going to be saying along the same lines, then what's the problem? The Torah says, Asima alai melech, and they also said, Asima alai melech. So what's the problem? So why is Shmuel upset? Tanya Rav Eliezer, and there's Kenim Shabaderek Kahagan Shalu, the elders, the Tamar Chachamim, I guess, of the people act properly. They act properly. Shenema, as the pasuk says, no lot of melech l'shofteinu. As they said in that Perek in Shmuel, give us a king to judge us. Fine, that's a legitimate reason to have a king, that he should judge the people when in cases where the Sanhedrin doesn't have the authority to. Aval, Amiya Oretz Shebehen Tukulu. But the Amiya Oretz of that time asked wrongly. They were saying, we want a king to lead us in war. They say we want to be like all the other nations, and our king will judge us, the Yasalafanenu, and he'll go before us and then fight our wars. That was not the right thing. That they should have realized the Eved is running.
What do we expect?
Amir also supposed to know. They're supposed to realize that the Eved is their king. You know what? In previous generations, you find a couple of the Shoftim where the Jewish people Taka asked them, be our king. And they said, and one of them, Gidon, actually, who wasn't especially one of the great Tamar Chachamim among the Shoftim. He was one of the Kaleol, as Amir calls him elsewhere. And he says, I'm not going to be your king. The Eved is your king. So they should have realized it still in small time. Yeah. Rav Yossi says the same list as Rav Yehuda before. The Jewish people were commanded three mitzvahs to do after they come into Israel. Lahamid lahamelech, to set themselves up a king. Or lahachas zara shalamolech, to wipe out the Amalek. Velubnas land base of Chira, and to build the Bismarck. Now, which one comes first? What is the proper order? Now, you wouldn't know from the psukim which one comes first.
No,
after a king, that's what we're going to say. Second, the king's job is to do it. That's why, after Shmuel was anointed by Shmuel, is when Shmuel comes and tells him, now that you've been anointed by the Eved, it's fine. And that's the story. It was still a recognizable nation in those times. They lived in their territory and whatever, yeah. So what is the order? All three of these things, the pasuk says, when you come into Eretz Yisrael, but it doesn't say what order, which one comes first. So we can figure it out like this. The pasuk says, after the first war with Amalek in Parashat Shalach, Moshe says, Hashem's hand is on his throne. That will be war against Hashem against Amalek. So the word throne implies a king. So that means there has to be a king first, sitting on the throne, before we deal with Amalek. In Kisei Elamelech, the word Kisei specifically refers to the king. As the passage says, Shlomo sat on the throne of Hashem to be the king. So we see that the word Kiska means the throne of the human king of the Jewish people.
So that comes first.
Once a king is enthroned, then it's time to deal with Amalek. Next, what comes between the other two things? What comes first? Wipe out Amalek or build the Mishmash? When the pasuk says in the pasuk says that Hashem will give you rest from all your enemies around you, and then the place that Hashem chooses, you'll build the Mishmash. So wiping out Amalek, who were harassing the Jewish people, comes first. And in fact, we can find that historically by David. When David was sitting in his palace in peace, Hashem had made him peaceful from all the enemies around. Then, Steve, the next pasuk says, "Vayemer Hamelach al Nosan." Actually, the same pasuk, "Vayemer Hamelach al Nosan Anavi." The king says to Nosan Anavi, "Ve'ena Anochi Yosef Beis Adrosim." Look, I'm living in a palace made out of cedar wood. The Aron of the Eved is in a tent. Isn't it time to build a Beis Mikdash? And at first, Nosan agrees, and then the Eved tells Nosan, "Go tell David, it's not time yet. So you yourself are not going to build the Beis Mikdash, and anyway, the time of wars is not over yet. It's going to wait for Shlomo." But we see that David had the right idea. He said, "I have to wait till after those people."
Same thing with
Mashiach,
who has to wipe Amalek first.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, the Rambam didn't mention specifically wiping out Amalek, but the Rambam mentioned that you have Cheskes Mashiach, Yochem Mishkanos Hashem Yinaseach, which presumably includes fighting against Amalek, and eventually the Yivne Mitzvah Shmim Kaim, but he has to say Israel. Yeah, I got the same thing.
I think that it means to fight physical war.
It might. It might not. I mean, it depends. You know, it may well. Yeah. You have to learn in Yonah Gula and Mashiach. You have to learn some of the circles of the Rebbe on that subject to see. But Bukhura, it could mean physical war. Yeah. Okay. Anyway. Alright. Since we're talking about kingship, and in particular we're talking about Shlomo sitting on the throne, so now we're going to digress a minute and talk about the extent of Shlomo's kingship. And the history of what happened with it. It's ups and downs. Amar Shlomo, Betchila Malach Shlomo Alo Yoinim. Originally, Shlomo Malach ruled before, Rashi says, before he started marrying women from the surrounding nations, which, by the way, there again, that I'm going to make the point of saying in Hilchos Issur Revi'a, they weren't goites. Chas v'shalom, that Shlomo, who was called the beloved of the Eivishter, would marry goites. They weren't this geyer, but it wasn't necessarily a geyrus that should have been done, because in the time of David and Shlomo, you're not supposed to be accepting geyrim anyway. Preposterous. Anybody who's being this geyer might be doing it because of wealth, power, and whatever. So they were geyrim. No, the fact is they were geyrim. They did have tevilah. They did do kabbalah for mitzvahs, but it may not have been sincere. So the bata dinim of that time said, basically, we'll have to wait and see. Before we talk about Achav twice. Apparently, yes, because again, otherwise, how are her children considered Jews? Her children
would have converted.
Then they still wouldn't. Okay, but first of all, no. Achecha, Mekerav Achecha, Tosim Alach HaMelech, a Jewish king, is not allowed to be a ger. We don't have that connection with that group.
Good point.
So then, his children after him, first Achaziah and then Yehoram, became kings. Yeah, yeah. So apparently she converted. Afterwards, unfortunately, she was called the Lasura. She went back to acting like a goiter, but that didn't necessarily invalidate.
So wait a minute. So even though she went back, the children still became kings.
Because the fact is, she did have a proper geirus. It's like any born Jew who does have heirs. Okay, anyway, let's continue. So Batzila Malach Shlomo Alo Yonim. Originally, Shlomo Malach ruled even over the upper, the Ruchniyistic beings. Shenema Vayeshev Shlomo Akis Hashem, the same pasuk that we just quoted before. Shlomo sat on the throne of the Eivishter. So just like the Eivishter rules over the upper and lower world, so also did Shlomo.
The Eivishter wanted Shlomo to build a bit. I mean, David had too much.
Because David, on the face of it, yeah, because Shlomo, because David had spilled too much blood in his wars, but also, yeah, there's a medrash that says that also the Eivishter told David that if you build the Beis Hamikdash, it will never be destroyed, right. And there needs to be an opening that if the Jewish people do have Eirus, that the Beis Hamikdash should be destroyed rather than them. Yeah, indeed. David didn't build it. Shlomo built it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
If David had built it,
it never would have been destroyed. Yeah. Okay.
And that's why he didn't want
and
to.
And that's why they did. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So he had in mind.
He wanted
that when it was built, it's in order to be destroyed.
Not in order to be, but there has to be the possibility of it being destroyed rather than the Jewish people being destroyed. Okay. All of a sudden, Malach Halach Tachtonim. Eventually, after he married these women, Shlomo was his kingship was restricted, and he only came to rule over the lower beings, over the world. He ruled over the whole side of the river. Mitifsach Vad Aza, from Tifsach to Aza. Now, where is Tifsach and where is Aza? Rabu Shmuel, Chad Oma Tifsach v'Sofa Olam, Ba'Aza v'Sofa Olam. One of them says that they're on opposite ends of the world, so therefore it means he ruled over the whole world, the all known
world. The Aza we know today.
Could be the Aza we know today, but it could be a different, there's a couple of different Tifsachs. There's actually one of them not far from Aza, as the Gemara is going to say, and there's another one like up near the Frost River or something. The other opinion says that Tifsach and Aza were right next to each other, meaning as easy as it was for him to rule over Tifsach and Aza, because they're right next to each other, with that same ease, he ruled over the whole world. Yeah, they have the same kind of machlokes as far as Hodu and Kush, yeah.
Same
argument, Rav and Shmuel, yeah.
We still don't know which one's in which.
Yeah. All of a sudden, when Moloch El Al Yisrael, eventually, though, Shlomo's kingship shrank even further, and he only ruled over the Jewish people. Because as we're going to see later on in the Gemara, he was over on some of the averus that apply to a king. So therefore, his kingship shrank and shrank.
He was even before to rule over Shadim and Malachim.
For Shadim and Malachim, and then only over all of humanity, and then afterwards only over the Jewish people. Shenema, as the pasuk says, Ani Kehelos, so you see Melech HaYisrael. I mean, he says, I Kehelos was king over the Jewish people, implying, but not anybody else. Yeah. All of a sudden, like Malach El Al Yerushalayim, eventually his kingship shrank, and he's only ruling over Yerushalayim. Shenema Divrei Kehelos Ben David Melach Be Yerushalayim. The words of Kehelos Ben David, who was king in Yerushalayim. We're not even finished. All of a sudden, like Malach El Al Mitosei, eventually there came a point that he only ruled over his own bed. Shenema Hini Mitosei Shalosh Shlomo. As the passage says, behold, there's a bed of Shlomo.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, like Malach El Al Maklei, and eventually he only ruled over his stick. As it says, as in the end, also in Kehelet, he says, in the end, this is all, this was my portion. This is all I have left from all my hard work. Now, what does he mean, this is my portion? This implies something that he's pointing to. Again, you have a machlokes of Rav Shmuel, chadam amakwe, chadam agundai. One says it means a stick. This is talking about Rashi says after Ashmedai kicked him off the throne. We know the famous story in Gittin where Ashmedai impersonated him and kicked him off the throne. So during that period, he only had a stick, according to one mandama. The chadam agundai, the other one says gundai. Rashi brings two explanations. One is that it means his cloak, talus. And they bring this from Rabbi Hai Goin that it means an earthenware vessel, like that he used for drinking and washing his hands or whatever. He was very poor. There are some of the Mefarshim, though, who say a little bit differently. They say it's not quite that bad. What it means, makloi, means that he still had the ability still to rule by force. He had still had the stick with the ability. And gundai, according to them, means a group of people who were still willing to follow him. Gundai can also mean a small troop of soldiers or whatever.
Right.
Question is, Hodor Eloi Hodor, in the end, did Shlomo return to his full rule or not? So it's a machloika, yet again, Rav Shmuel. Chadam Hodor, Chadam Eloi Hodor. One says he eventually returned to his full glory, including Allah Yoinim and everything, and the other one says not. Mandam Eloi Hodor, the one who says he didn't return, we can summarize that his rule was Melech Behediot. He was a king, and then he was a khan. Mandam Hodor, the one who says he returned, would hold that it's Melech Behediot or Melech. He was a king. For a while, he was in the middle there. He was a commoner, and later on, he became a king. Yeah.
Sounds such a simple thing. Why do we have to? Got chicken feet. Take his socks off. You remember that?
Yeah.
We don't know.
We don't know. It's the machlokes. You're asking why they have to use the expression?
Yeah.
You're asking why they have to summarize a Melech Behediot or Melech?
Yeah.
Because you could.
Well, it is very partial.
Okay, but the question is, if we're saying he didn't return, automatically that implies he was Melech Behediot. Why do you need to spell it out?
It shows his fall from being a Melech to
being a Behediot, and then he's back to being a Melech again. I don't know.
It shows.
Yeah.
Like
yeah. Right. I mean, the truth is, it brings over here from that Gemara and Gittin that Marshal says over there that what it means is, even according to the opinion Melech Behediot, doesn't mean he died as a commoner. The fact is, the prophet says he ruled for 40 years and died and was buried in the graves of the kings over there in Yerushalayim.
Right.
So he definitely died as a king. What we mean, according to the opinion Melech Behediot, he never came back to being a king in the full sense like he was before. He was a king. He still sat on a throne, he still wore a crown or whatever, but he wasn't a king in the full sense of the world. That is Melech Halal. Your name is Melech Halal. So he wasn't, not totally a Behediot, but a Behediot compared to what he was before. As opposed to Melech, a Behediot to Melech means he's full-fledged Melech as much as he was before.
According to Marshall, in both opinions, he got rid of Ashmedai.
Yeah, the Gemara says afterwards that they were able to get rid of him. Yeah.
Get the dark
wall
back.
Okay.
And so I
they wrote Kehelet, and Kehelet is his researchers on what's the meaning of life, what's the purpose of life.
He said it after he gave up the whole world.
After all, all I have left is my stick or whatever. Yeah.
Different stages.
That's what we're saying. Yeah. Yeah. Within. Yeah.
What's about it? It shows him doing life experience.
Okay, but nevertheless, it's a terrible downfall for him. So, yeah. Okay. Going back to the mission at the Potiphar's
lot.
Okay, the Mishnah said Torah philosophus legeris, that a king is allowed to break through people's fences, fields, or whatever to make a pass, and we said that we're not really focusing on that. The Gemara discusses that in other places. The Gemara is going to focus on the last line of the Mishnah. We said that everybody, when they gather spoils during the battle, then afterwards they have to bring it to the king picks whatever he wants, and the rest they divide. So, turn it up. Oitzris malachim lamelos. If they take spoils, if they take the treasures that belong to other kings that are captured in battle, those go immediately to the king.
Oh.
So if they capture the capital city, for example, and they capture the palace, and they have whatever the king kept in his treasury, or once in a while, sometimes you have kings who bring out their treasuries to encourage the people or whatever. You know, they have the famous expression of chiddus all over, right, where the king takes out the oitzris, that is, that he and his ancestors have been storing up a generation to spread out among his army to encourage them to pay him. Yeah. So that immediately goes to the king. The rest of the spoils that they collect, half of it goes to the king, the other half is divided among the people. Well, it becomes part of the king's treasury. I mean, it's not that how much can a person use for himself. No, I mean, a good king will use his treasuries for the use of the people. But the fact is, it's his treasury. It's his to do with whatever he wants with it. Amalir of Abai Lir of Dimis, Abai Asr of Dimis, Vami Lolir of Acha, or others say Abai Asr of Acha, Vishlema Oitzris Malacham Amalach. I can understand why the treasuries of the foreign kings, why they go to the king, Uruchan Amilsa. Fine, that's normal, that the treasury of a king should go to a king.
Uruchan
Amilsa? It's the regular way of doing things. El Shah Vizish Bozin, but you're saying the rest of the spoils, Mechtel Amalach and Mechtel Am, you're saying half of it goes to the king, half to the people. Manola, where do you get that from? The answer is dichtiv, because you have a pasuk in Divrei Yomim that says, "Vayimshachu Hashem l'nogid ulatzadik l'koyim." The pasuk says that they anointed Shloimer as the nogid, which is another word for king, and they anointed Tzadik as the Kohen Gadol. Makish nogid l'tzadik, which means we're making a hekesh therefore between the nogid, the king, and Tzadik, the Kohen Gadol. Ma Tzadik mechzaloy or mechzalach. Just like the Tzadik, just like when they divided for lachem upon him, as we're going to see in a second, half of it went to the Kohen Gadol and the other half to all the other Kohenim. The same thing with the Kohen God, the same thing with the king. But Tzadik Gufamino. Between half to the king, half to the subject. But Tzadik Gufamino. And how do we know by Tzadik himself, by the Kohen God? The Tanya, we learned in Braisa, we learned this a few weeks ago in Baba Basra. Rebbe Yomer, the Hoytzel Aaron of the Bonham, the Pesach says that the Lacham Aponim should be to Aaron and to his children, implying Mechzel Aaron and Mechzel Bonham, half to Aaron, half to his son. So that's how it is. So that's how we get the Kohen God, and from that we get the king.
What happened?
Why should we think that half of it goes to the king? A percentage goes to the king. Fine. Why half? Yeah. Okay. We are behind. Whatever. We'll learn a little more. We have a few more minutes. Okay. The Mishnah says Lo Yagra Lo Noshim. The Pasuk says on a Jewish king, he's not allowed to have too many wives. What's the maximum? El Shmoneh. So he's allowed to have 18. We'll learn in the Gemara where we get 18.
That's not too many.
Disappointing.
Hold on. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Margahu Loi Wavachala Yumasiris Sliver. Rabbi Yehuda says he's allowed to have many as long as they don't turn his heart away from the Eishta. The Pasuk says that he should not have many wives below Yosu Lavav, right? His heart shouldn't turn away. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda understands the fact that it's meant as a condition on it. There is actually Machloikas Rishonim. Is Rabbi Yehuda arguing with Tanakama or not? Is he saying that the Tanakama is saying 18, and Rabbi Yehuda is saying that even within 18, they can't be Mesiris as Libra? Or is he saying, as long as they're not Mesiris as Libra, as long as they're all Tzidkanis, you can have more than 18? Rabbi Shimon, I'm after the Achas of Mesiris as Libra, Harei Zalai Sanner. Rabbi Shimon says, no, if she's Mesiris as Libra, if she's going to turn him away from the Eivishter, he wouldn't be allowed to marry her. So why does it say lo yabel enoshim? Daftulu kavigayel. It means even if all of them are tzidkanias and nevias like Abigail, there's still a limit.
And did Abigail live?
Abigail was one of David's wives. So the question is, like Mar says, lememra of Yehuda dorish taimer dekra. Are you telling me that it seems from the Mishnah that Rabbi Yehuda is darshining based on the reason in the pasuk that when the reason applies, the mitzvah applies, and when not, the not? But Rabbi Shimon loy dorish, and Rabbi Shimon does not seem to be doing that because he's saying 18 regardless. But we find in another case we find exactly the opposite. The Tanya, as we learn in a Braisa. Almana, now the Torah tells us in Parshas Ki Seitzei, Loisachal Beged Almana, that you're not allowed to take as a mashtone the garment of an Almana. So the Mishnah says in Bava Metzia, we learned this in Bava Metzia, Almana ben shi yaniya ben shi yashira eim mashkenosa, and Almana, whether she's poor or rich, you're not allowed to take a mashken from her. Shenema Loisachal Beged Almana, Divir Rav Yehuda, Rav Shimon Omer, Rav Shimon.
You're not to get a beged, mashken,
or anything. Rabbi Shimon says if she's rich, you are allowed to take a mashkin from her. Only a poor one you're not, because what would be the problem with a poor one? Because the Pesukim describe over there that if a person is poor and they need this particular thing every night, a pair of pajamas, for example, then you have to return it to them every night. So like this, you're going to have to be returning it to her every day or every night, as the case may be. After a while, you're going to be visiting her every day. You're going to be making that she's going to have a bad name among her neighbors. People are going to think you're coming there for Averis with her, for Znus with her. So therefore, if she's rich and she doesn't need it every day, then you don't have that problem, says Rav Shimon. So in other words, Shimon, then you don't, because if she's rich, then she doesn't need it every day. She has many pairs of pajamas or whatever. So therefore, the Shimon is darshaning time of dikra and saying only where the underlying reason behind the thing applies, namely she's poor and you have to return it to her every day, then the mitzvah applies, when not, then not. Whereas in our Mishnah, it seems the other way around. Rabbi Huda is the one who's doing that. Okay, Vamrinan, and we say, what do you mean? What do you mean? Va'atachai la'atala, va'atamafia, my karma, what do we mean? Hacha karma, what we mean is, mitochshe, after a mashkana, because you take the mashkana, atachai la'atala, because of that, the Torah imposes on you to return it to her every day, va'atamafia, shem rabishkana se'a, and then when you return it to her every day, then it's going to give her a bad name. Amr, Rabbi Huda, loy dodish time of the cross. So we see over there, Rabbi Huda is not darshaning the underlying reasoning behind the thing, but Rabbi Shimon dodish time of the cross, and Rabbi Huda, and Rabbi Shimon is. So how does that fit with our Mishnah?
Right.
The answer is Ba'alma Rabbi Huda loy darsh time of the Kura. In general, Rabbi Huda does not hold of darshin and time of the Kura. The shiny hacha, but he would say this case is different. The mafarish time of the Kura. In the case of the mashkin from Namana, the Torah doesn't say anything about rich or poor. You, Rabbi Shimon, are adding it. So therefore, Rabbi Huda says, I'm not obligated to accept it. And in other cases also, the Torah doesn't spell out a reason. Here, the Torah itself spells, in this case, where the Torah spells out a reason, Ma tam lo yavol noshim, why should he not have too many wives? Mishum de lo yosu lovave, Rabbi Yehuda says, because the Torah wants to, that his heart should not be turned away from the Eivishter, so therefore implying, if they're not going to turn away his heart, then it's not a problem. Yeah. Rabbi Shimon on the loch, whereas Rabbi Shimon would answer you, Nechti ba'alma darshin in time of the Kura, according to Rabbi Shimon, you always darshin in time of the Kura. So the Torah should just say he can't have too many wives, not give a reason. And we ourselves would figure out a reason. Why shouldn't he have too many? Because then he'll be too distracted from serving the Mishter. Why does the Torah have to spell out a reason if in general we're expected to look for reasons ourselves? It must be that the Torah is telling us one or the other. Even if it's only one, but she's Masira es libra, you can't marry her. Elamani, Makayim, Lo Yarba, what is it? It's true, Lo Yosu Lavav. In other words, Rav Shimon is saying these are two separate statements. Number one, Lo Yarba Lenoshim, which is an absolute statement, never more than 18 regardless. Number two, Lo Yosu Lavav, if it's even one of them, it's going to be Lo Yosu Lavav, you can't marry her. So what is the. So it's both. Lo Yosu Lamali, that's the thing, you need both. Lo Yosu Lamali, why do you need the word Lo Yosu? After La Achas Masira es Libra Harei Zalai Sana, even if it's only one who's Masira es Libra, don't marry her. Elamani, Makayim, Lo Yagra. So what does Lo Yagra mean? It's a separate thing. The Afilu Kavigayo, even if the 18 are all Tikonius, like Kavigayo, you still can't. So in other words, according to Rabbi Huda, it's a mitzvah and a reason. Therefore, no reason, no mitzvah.
Yeah.
According to Rabbi Shimon, it's two separate statements.
Yeah,
two separate dinim.
No.
According to Rav Shimon, it's one or the other. If you have a woman who is going to be maseret libra, a woman who is going to turn a king away from the Eivishter, he's not allowed to marry her, even if it's his first wife or his second. Lo yagra means even if he finds 19 tzidkoniyos, he can't marry all 19.
In other words, the two reasons: one is less than the 19.
One applies to anyone who will be maseret libra, right? And the other one is even less than 19.
And then
the other one is. A limit, an absolute limit of 18, regardless. Yeah.